So I was asked to give a quick review of these. Gary Steigman will be talking after me on a similar topic area, and he'll focus more on how neutrinos fit into explaining the data things I'm going to emphasize at the moment. So look for me to tell you which data are more reliable and where the tensions are from the data side, and Gary to explain where the neutrino physics fits into this. These are exciting times in cosmology. This is our favorite data set at the moment. This is a small portion of the sky from the Wilkinson MAP satellite. The scale here is about 5 degrees between my fingers there. The measurement of this data set has produced something that we speculated about a decade ago. This is a list of cosmological numbers that you can find from the MAP papers, and the error bars are given on there for a large variety of numbers that change cosmology fundamentally. It's gone from an area where a wide variety of speculations were possible and barely testable to an area where there's now very little room for maneuver in most areas, right? Most ideas you can now think of are multiply constrained and, in fact, are non-starters. So it's a very exciting time. I'll be talking about a tiny part of that relates to Big Bang nuclear synthesis directly, and I think Gary will talk about another part related to neutrinos. So in Big Bang nuclear synthesis, in the first 3 minutes, so we're starting out with neutrons and protons, and we're going to end up with these five light nuclei: helium, deuterium, tritium, lithium 7. The quantities that are produced depend on one main parameter, which is eta here. So this is a number we'd like to be able to measure. There's some vague hope of one day being able to calculate it, which would be quite exciting. It can also be stated in terms of a baryon density. So sometimes you'll hear us talk about eta and sometimes a baryon density. The photon density is known from the microwave background temperature, and hence the conversion is well known between the two. So I'm going to be talking about primarily about deuterium, and I'll explain why that is. Deuterium has several observational advantages. One is that if we measure deuterium to hydrogen, we're measuring isotopes of the same element. So for an observer, this means you do not have to correct for the ionization. This notation means neutral deuterium and neutral hydrogen, which is what we see in absorption lines in the ultraviolet. And that should be identical to the ratio of the amount of atoms that we see. No ionization correction. That's unusual. For the other elements, you don't have that advantage. Deuterium is quite common, and it's easily seen in the Lyman series lines. I'm going to be showing you ultraviolet spectra. We look at quasars because they have in front of them gas clouds that have very low metal abundances. Now, the significance of that's as follows. When gas goes inside a star, the deuterium is destroyed. When gas is ejected from the star, the hydrogen comes out, but no deuterium. But metals come out, heavy elements, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and so on. So wherever you see significant carbon, nitrogen, or oxygen, you should expect that deuterium is missing. Nearby to the Earth, that's always the case. But towards distant quasars, you can find places where that's not important, and so you should see the primordial deuterium. And, a cartoon of what we see looks like this. This explains redshift and spectra, and I'll be showing you a few spectra along the way here. The horizontal axis is wavelength, so red at this end and ultraviolet at the other end. There's the quasar, and there's the light coming towards us. There are gas clouds along the line of sight. The main absorption we see in a quasar spectrum is caused by neutral hydrogen, Lyman alpha line. Because of redshift, the Lyman alpha line appears at a position in the spectrum that depends on the location of the cloud along the line of sight. So spectrum is like a distance map, if that makes sense. Wavelength is going to be similar to distance. This is what the deuterium should look like in three different sketches. If you have a small amount of deuterium, more and more and so on. This main line here is hydrogen. The hydrogen saturates, so you could not see from this line how much was there, but it's about 30,000 times the deuterium, right? So you're expecting something like that. So we use telescopes mostly on the ground. These are the Keck telescopes in Hawaii. We use them because they're big. We need a lot of light to make these measurements. They can also be done from space, but they're not as good. So this is our first deuterium measurement from 1996 from the Keck telescope. And I'll point out how to read this data. I point this out because it relates to whether or not deuterium is constant, etc. So what we're looking at here is a spectrum sliced up into slices that go along the Lyman series. So the Lyman series should show up for hydrogen at what we've called zero velocity, which is here. So all of this is hydrogen absorption in the different Lyman lines. And deuterium is then predicted to be over here. From the hydrogen, you can predict the deuterium. These three little marks show ways of modeling asymmetry in the gas distribution. So that there is the deuterium. And the amount of light missing here, this is flux vertically, and there's the what it would have been without the deuterium, tells you how much deuterium you got. And I'll show a little more about some of these later. So here's another one. We've now got several of these. I'm going to show you how we interpret them. So all of this stuff here is hydrogen absorption along the line of sight. Right? It's intergalactic gas, and it's slightly varying in density. Here's the hydrogen. There's enough hydrogen here to absorb photons down here that have enough energy to ionize the gas so that the flux is all gone here. And this tells us that there's a good chance of seeing deuterium connected to this gas. There's also a Lyman series. There'll be a beta, a gamma, a delta, and so on, right down in this region. So there's the enlargement of the same spectrum. And from this, you could almost measure the D to H ratio from what I'm showing you now. Here's the hydrogen, and this curve here shows a model fit that already has the amount of hydrogen specified. Right? And so the quality of that fit here and here and here tells you how well we know the amount of hydrogen in this particular gas cloud. And down here, you can see the same hydrogen fitting the Lyman series lines. And you can see it fits quite well here. This is likely to give a good hydrogen measurement. An issue with the hydrogen is where is the continuum level? And that's shown by this dotted line. We don't know what it would have been without the hydrogen absorption. And if we guess that incorrectly, we'll get the amount of hydrogen wrong, right? Which will change the D to H. In this case, it'll be an error of perhaps 5%, something like that. These are the deuterium lines. You can see four of them here. There's a lot of hydrogen. There's quite a lot of deuterium. So there it is in the beta line. That's the deuterium there. Right? There it is in the gamma, the third line. Right, five and six. Reasonably noisy here, you can see from the fluctuations here in the photon counts. So that was one of our best cases. The problems you have with this type of measurement are fairly simple. It's the fact that the hydrogen is about 30,000 times more common than deuterium, and it tends to swamp the deuterium. It can look like the deuterium. It can partially cover the deuterium or completely cover it. So you have to look at hundreds of quasars to find one that'll work. I show that graphically here. Here is a quasar spectrum, right? And the deuterium line would look identical to one of these little things. Right? This particular quasar does not show it, and nor do another 99 in this sequence. You have to look through a lot of them to find one that works. The way you can distinguish deuterium, and you should look for this in a measurement that you're going to base some credence on, is line widths. And this is very, very simple description here. This thing B is root 2 times a sigma for a Gaussian width. So it's how wide's the line? What you see is a turbulent part where the deuterium and hydrogen are moving together, plus a thermal part, which will depend on the temperature of the gas divided by the mass of the ion you're talking about, plus an instrumental bit, which you know. So you can solve for these two terms if you observe several ions of different mass. right, in the same gas, and that's what we do. Such that you expect hydrogen to be wider than deuterium and so on down the series, right? So if you do not have that, then you may not be looking at deuterium and you may get the wrong value. This shows some lines, carbon, silicon, nitrogen. You can see we can easily measure the width of these. It's quite easy to do that. And that shows roughly what it would look like. The equation I just showed you was in B squared, right, against 1 upon mass, should be a straight line of a slope determined by the temperature of the gas, which should be about 10,000 Kelvin. So there's the hydrogen, and there's oxygen down here. There's a bunch of other elements down here. Some of these are from more ionized gas, so it's okay for it to be a little bit hotter, to have slightly different motions. But the oxygen and hydrogen and deuterium should be in the same gas. Almost exactly, not quite, but almost. So this line is drawn without looking at the deuterium. It just fits the oxygen and the hydrogen. So that shows you this is D. Right? If this test fails, then it's probably contaminated with hydrogen. So our most recent measurement, shown here, it's similar in quality to the one I was just showing you. So this is a Lyman series. There's the hydrogen. There's the D position, and you can see the deuterium here, 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 and so on.
Mm-hmm. What is the recovery on the right side of the center of the line?
Mm-hmm. Over here?
Yeah.
Okay. You can see the up here, there's absorption way over to here, right here, but now it's going away because we jump, let's see, 2, 3, 4. So what this means is that at this particular velocity, from the point of view of where the deuterium is, there's not as much absorption, about 150 kilometers a second away in Doppler sense, right? So what this means is that there's a gas cloud centered at this velocity and one over here somewhere, but they're not related to the D cloud, which turns out it's over here that you'd see from the end of the Lyman series. So, it's just additional annoying absorption.
How many components would you say you see?
Well, ones that are contributing to the measurement too, yeah. Right? Ones that needed to fit this panel, many more, right? But they're not very interesting. So on that line, this shows you some more. This is the same gas cloud. Okay, complicated, and so on, right? But these are slightly more ionized than the main gas. The main gas is represented by the oxygen 1. And you can see there. So how many components would you say that was, right? Well, that turns out to be our main error. If that O1 is completely symmetric, then there's one component, right, and dominated by the thermal width. But there seems to be a little wing. You see that over here? Maybe 10, 13%, something like that. So that's actually our main error. In the D part of the spectrum, that same profile is going to look something like this. Now that here, 1 is the velocity of that main oxygen, and 2, this little bit over here, you can see it more clearly perhaps there, is the asymmetry. Right? And we obviously do not know how much D is at position 2. Right? Could be similar to the oxygen, could be a little bit less, somewhere in that range. So that's about a 10% error from that. This is not atypical of what a D measurement would look like. The other part of the error term is where's the continuum level? And you can see some different lines drawn on here. The thing in the middle is the hydrogen. If I blow that up and I fit it and I give it various amounts of degrees of freedom, 2 or 3 degrees of freedom in this region, I get something like that. And there's the amount of hydrogen. If I want to fit it with less hydrogen, 1 sigma less hydrogen. I just overlay this and you can see what happens. You can see the continuum drops down. You see that bowing? I turn around and can see, yeah, that works, right? We don't know exactly where the continuum is, so that's roughly where you get the error from, right? And the same if you want to go higher. If you want more hydrogen, you let the continuum go up, right? And that's also reasonable. And that's what gives us our errors on the hydrogen. So a summary then of where these data are. There are other measurements, and they tend to have obvious types of problems with them. There's less signal-to-noise ratio. It makes it very hard to work out how to model it. Unknown velocity structure. You don't see the Lyman series, don't have the resolution, or a lot of contamination. These are all common problems, and they can lead to very different values. This is a space telescope measurement by Patini and Bowen from a year ago. So this is the Lyman series line, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. And I've shown enlargement of 12 and 9, which is where the D is from the same spectrum. Right, so here's Lyman line, and I'm 12, and there's D there. And it's been fit by differing amounts. Space telescopes are very small telescope, low efficiency. It has trouble producing the signal to noise that we're used to. Right? There's about 100 times less photons in this spectrum. And hence not as reliable a value. So there's a summary of the data, and I'll show you this graphically in a second as I come back out of the detailed part of this. So I showed you the first one. I didn't show you this one yet. I showed you that one. I just showed you this one. This is a space telescope one. There's one other one that's discussed. This one, the D is not separately seen. It's completely blended in, and hence much less reliable, and most of us would not use that one. And the astro pH number is where you can get all of these from there. So the mean of the top five, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, which is our best guess as to what to do, is that. These have quite a dispersion if you look at these for a second. So what we take as the error is not the weighted mean. We'd find that a very dangerous thing to do because it would be a small error like that. But rather it's just the standard deviation of the data divided by root 5, right, which is that number. So in other words, we're not using these errors except for a guide as to the weighting. And the WMAP value for D in standard Big Bang will be about that. So very, very similar number. So now graphically it gets more interesting. So this is the data you just saw. It's now plotted against an axis which is a logarithm of the amount of oxygen divided by the amount of hydrogen, such that the sun is here, 1/10 of the sun is here, and 1/100 and 1/1000 and so on. This curve and the one underneath it show a very likely destruction model for deuterium, where as gas comes out of stars, there's oxygen produced, so you move over this direction, and there's deuterium destroyed. It's not until about, let's say, 10% of the atoms have been in stars, somewhere around here, that the destruction becomes significant, and you see significant amount of oxygen or silicon. Right? So that's roughly what you expect. This is gas near the sun, quite consistent. There's a fair error on these predictions. You can slide them up or down quite a bit, but that's the general trend of it. So the prediction is that these data should agree. Should be one number, right? And they should be measuring, unless the universe is somehow inhomogeneous. And I'm now going to talk about that little issue. This is an upper limit where the value could be anywhere down to zero, so it's not relevant to this. Right? Yeah, these are what we hope are once, well, we hoped past tense, right? They're obviously not, right? Unless there's dispersion in the universe. So let's talk about this one up here. This is from our group from a few years ago. So this is what it looks like. This is the hydrogen, Lyman alpha. This is unrelated hydrogen, as is that, and so on. This is the deuterium. I know where the deuterium should be because I have the Lyman series, and here they are. And you can see the green curve fits very well. I've got no trouble telling where that is, which means that I know exactly where the hydrogen is centered, and hence where the deuterium is centered. Right? Now, if you stare at that, you pretty quickly see there's something else going on, which is this, right up here. So here we've dotted it in. This is some unrelated hydrogen that is a similar position to the deuterium, and it's absorbing some of the light, so I should have a little SD. This model gives that number up there, high, right? 2 sigma high. Okay. If instead this dotted line were to continue right across like that, right, I would absorb more of the light with hydrogen, less with D. This point would come down to just above the line, to about 3, somewhere around there, right? So when we say these are the error bars, these are based on normal statistical chi-squared type things. And how well we know that depends on how well we know the shape of the D. The shape of the D must be the same as the shape of the hydrogen, and that's the data that was based on, right? So how well does that curve fit, right? It's very noisy down here. Right? So the point I'm trying to make is that it's quite reasonable to assume that the amount of hydrogen here is more than was modeled, right? And hence at this point could move down, right? Could of course go the other way too. So you can guess what we're doing. We're working more on this object, so we can, we obviously need more data. This is a 12 hours of data, which is a lot in astronomy. But we'll make better measurements of that and sort it out. Now, same data, different axis. Does look like a correlation, right? Looks very much like one. This is the amount of hydrogen gas that's neutral against DDH again. It's not the total amount of gas, just the amount of neutral. If you work out how ionized it is, turns out they're all about the same. So it's just a neutral fraction. In the sense that these have more neutral gas, they also have a higher gas density. It's likely to be connected. So these are lower density. A little bit bigger. These are smaller, higher density, right? Looks like correlation. There's no reasonable explanation for this whatsoever, right? Absolutely none.
So H1 is observed for that class.
Correct. Exactly right. Yep. So it's the environment where I saw it, right? Mm-hmm.
Isn't it true that the probability of intervening cloud of the possible column rising back?
Correct. Yep. Certainly true. That's right. Yeah. So that will be a bias, meaning that there are many more things like that than there are like this, right? On the other hand, these are easier to see in the spectrum because they make a bigger effect. So when I scan through hundreds of quasars, poor quality of data will show me these, whereas I'll need better. Does that make sense? So it kind of balances out. The population of the points on the horizontal axis is somewhat random. It's according to what we found. So if we completely sampled a given number of quasars, it'd be far more over here. Right. So that's a good point. Right. Anyway, so there's a proviso, right? Our understanding is we probably underestimated these error bars, despite our efforts, and we're going to try to do better than we've done by getting more data and being more careful in the modeling of the things. So same graph. This now shows in color the orange band, which extends down the bottom here, then is our 1 sigma range, just from the dispersion of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 points. And the W map is the purpley bit underneath that. So now we get into Big Bang again. So the orange band's now been taken from the D graph, which gives you a D range from here to here, right? And then from standard Big Bang, you have this prediction for the D against the eta number across the top, or the baryon density in the bottom, right? And then you see something worth thinking about here. This graph has looked about the same for about 8 years now, since the first deuterium measurement that we made, which was right in here. It hasn't, it's moved a little bit, it's come down slightly, but not hugely. Lithium, right, is less than you expect, about a factor of 3. And helium is also observed, these are observations, to be less than you expect, right? Also about a 2 sigma, roughly speaking, right? These are lithium data from Ryan. There are other active groups. They get slightly bigger numbers, but same sort of. In no case is lithium seen to be up here. And these are stars. And same true for helium, but these are now, these boxes are means of say, 50 observations, and the individual observations can be quite high in those cases. So is this a problem or not, right? It's roughly a 2 sigma difference. Yeah, so that is a tough one. And they have been known to be high for a while compared to the ones that Gary is involved of, which is this box here, Skillman, Olive. That's been the same for quite a while. So I point out the fact that it hasn't changed for about 8 years because people would love to understand this and do something about it, right? It feels like observational difficulties. That's my understanding. I mean, helium's a hard measurement, and lithium, there may be some destruction. It's a much easier measurement. Certainly, it's not off by a factor of 3, perhaps. Right? So there's a little bit of something going on there. Yeah. Yeah, certainly. I can talk through them, but exactly right, right? They should agree, and perhaps a surprise that they didn't, right? They have data in common, even, right? So I'll now show a view graph that Gary might have been going to show. Maybe not. So here they are. These are similar to the two boxes, not exactly, but very similar, same groups and so on. So this is oxygen upon hydrogen, linear units, 0, 2 to 1, right? So what you want to know is the helium before the stars ejected any gas. Stars make quite a bit of helium. So you want the value of helium on this axis and on that axis. This unit mass fraction of helium is also called capital YP up there. That's all it is. So it's helium divided by hydrogen multiplied by the mass. Here's the isotopic one. It gives the high box on which the systematic errors by those authors are quoted to be quite small. And so the value comes in here. And we're predicting a somewhat higher value up about, but you know, a little bit higher. But you can see a fair bit of spread. And over here, there's more of a trend, of course, so you come lower. Does that help? There's many more levels of discussion as to what's going on there. Not known to be wrong, right? But sufficiently hard that representatives from both groups agree that the data could be in agreement with the WMAP and the deuterium, right? Meaning the systematic errors could be enough to allow, say, 0.25 up about here. Right? They're both quoted in the literature of saying that. But so let me say a tiny bit about helium-3 and then lithium. So helium-3 has been off this graph for many years, and the reason is the data do not give us a good understanding as to whether helium-3 is made or destroyed in the galaxy over time. Right. There's just not a lot seems to be going on, which means that the stars, on balance, could make a little or they could destroy a little, and we don't have observations from places where there are no metals. Right. So everywhere has been changed somewhat, but we don't know how much, up or down. The main group working on this, Bainier, Rood, the papers down here in Nature, they've been working on this for a long time. They have observed a lot of different nebula now. They point out, as I just said, not a lot going on, trends and so on. So they took one of their lowest values that had good data, and they said the helium-3 to hydrogen should be less than that measurement. And that's what they quote, and that's what we show. But not considered very useful for this argument. Considered in agreement, but not very supportive, even though it's showing a small error and so on. Right? It's just not very well understood there. So lithium. The data on lithium are very good. They're quite bright stars. Compared to the quasars, they're very easy to observe. And they've been done for many years. So this shows hydrogen upon iron, so an indication of how much change there might be, 10th solar, 100th, 1,000th, and so on. And this is a log of the amount of lithium in units with 12 added on. And these are some data, and they don't have a strong trend with the amount of iron. So this would make you think that you're seeing primordial lithium. There's also a fairly old plot. From Kopi, 1995. So here's more lithium data against temperature of star. And these stars are all old, and this corresponds to mass. And these guys are more massive, and these are a little less massive. Different sorts of stars show the same amount of lithium. Also suggests you're seeing the primordial lithium. So it's quite hard to understand how the stars can show very similar lithium and yet have lost about a factor of three. Right, so they come down a factor of three, but dispersion is about 10% in there, right, in that box or that area. There are certainly models that allow it, but it does not have to happen. There is a slight correlation with the amount of metals. This is more modern data from 1999, Ryan et al. That orange trend, you know, lithium changing a little bit, but not a lot. The point being, it's been observed quite carefully. These are now small errors here. Lithium-6 has also been seen. It's fragile, and the argument being, if you still see lithium-6, you cannot have destroyed too much, either 6 or 7, because the 7 would all have gone. Right? It's easily burned if it gets too far inside the star. So a little surprising that we would have seen that. So let me now move on to the microwave background. Here's a summary. So it's known in the last couple of years that the microwave background should be able to give us both the eta value, or equivalently the baryon density, to about 1% accuracy. It hasn't yet done that, but it seems highly likely it's going to do that. This then removes the last free parameter from the standard Big Bang nuclear synthesis, which allows you to explore other options. So in the simplest form, this is a test of Big Bang, and most practitioners would assume that's already been passed, because on this plot, it's the same plot, but if you put the Big Bang on it, the cosmic microwave background, it's predicting eta here, and Big Bang is giving there from deuterium. Most people assume then that test has been passed, meaning that we've got the basic things correct. Then we get into the differences. So the differences constrain production, as in non-standard Big Bang, and they constrain the assumptions that, in more general terms, take you from one measurement to the other. What do you have to do to connect the two measurements? And I'll talk a little bit about that in a second. So the bottom point on here, the omega b, the baryon density, times the Hubble constant, which is not interesting in this problem, from the microwave background, also depends on the slope of the power spectrum, and I'll show you a little bit about that in a second, this parameter NS, and also the optical depth of the universe for scattering. And this is some data from the WMAP paper, Spergel et al. And on the here and here, the black regions are preferred by the data. So horizontally is this slope. It's a slope on a power law, and preferred values are close to 1. And vertically is the amount of baryon. So if you get this wrong, you're going to get that wrong. Right? That's all I'm saying. Okay. So the effect of the baryon density on the microwave background is to change its shape. Of the power spectrum. So let me just show a map first. And this comes from boomerang data, so a couple of years old now. What we want to know is how much correlation is there on a particular angular scale. Right? And you measure the correlation for different angular scales. And for this problem, we're interested in about a fifth of a degree out to about 1 degree, that sort of range. So when you do that, what you end up with is something like this, and I believe you'll see many more of these plots later on this afternoon, so I'll briefly explain it. So horizontally then is angle, and there's 90 degrees on the sky, 2 degrees and so on a log scale, 0.2, usually expressed in terms of L. So these are spherical harmonics that are fitted to the sphere, the sky. Vertically is the amount of power. And what you see here is a peak, And you see it going down, another peak, and so on, another peak, and so on, right? I've messed the graph up a little bit by coloring it in, because I don't have a color printer for this, but there are two parts of data on here. The black points are the brand new ones from the WMAP satellite, and the red ones were a compilation of previous data just before the WMAP, many experiments there. And you can see they agree quite well. Right? So there are no huge surprises in this area coming from WMAP. The baryon density is given by the relative heights of this to this to this, and there are further peaks out here, but they've already got a couple of them quite well determined. So as the baryon density goes up, this peak will get higher relative to this peak. Right? So they'll kind of change relative height. And that measurement is fairly easily made from this type of data. Okay, so the earliest results indicated a much larger baryon density. Here's early boomerang. I just mentioned this so that you're synchronized. Exactly right. Yeah, just to synchronize it historically. The first MAP measurement, which was the first measurement of baryon density from the microwave background that's relevant to this, came out with quite a large value, this sort of number, whereas we're currently getting 2.2 or 2.1, somewhere like that. And that was corrected, right? So that's gone away and it's not, although there were papers on that topic. So just before MAP, it looked roughly like this. So that's what we're getting from standard Big Bang D, that number. So this is baryon density. So 2% of the closure density is baryons, and H squared is a half. So the baryon density about 4.4%, something like that. So there's a boomerang experiment, DAISY, Maxima, and so on. Right? They all agree. And you can do almost as well by other methods. This is not necessarily representative. This is a Steigman result recently. This is using the amount of hot gas in clusters of galaxies multiplied by a mass density. You get that number there. So. Not all measurements agree that well, but that's indicative of the result. So there's the WMAP data without the other points on them. So you can see that the height of this and this are now very well known. There are data from other experiments on there. So this is from Seibert, Fields, and Oliver. There are about half a dozen papers that now deal with what happens when you know the baryon density from the microwave background, and hence the Big Bang nuclear synthesis has no more free parameters in the simple model. Right? And this is one of those papers. It's a recent one. It'll refer back to the others. So this shows the deuterium to hydrogen value, 10 to minus 5. The curve is the data I was showing. It's exactly the number. And the WMAP value is the black area there, right? So they agree. The dashed line is what you get if you use a smaller set of the five quasars. Don't use all five. Helium-3, they don't show data. So as we knew then, for lithium, you're expecting more lithium than you see. Right? Deuterium says the same thing. And for helium, you're expecting more than you see. So are we comparing like items? There's a paper by Kaplinghat and Turner 2 years ago. Exactly tells you what you have to do to compare deuterium to Big Bang values for the eta, or the baryon density. So you have to assume the baryons are conserved, that nuclei are not being changed since the Big Bang period. For instance, there aren't some sources of energetic, some energy sources that are disrupting the nuclei in the early universe, for instance, that are being discussed. And then you also have to assume that the electromagnetic entropy per co-moving volume is conserved. It might go up, if say there are out of equilibrium decays of mass of particles, or it might go down. This is harder to imagine if the photons in the microwave background contact some cooler reservoir. In either case, these entropy changes have to happen very early, because the microwave background has very close to Planck spectrum. Right? So you're not allowed to dump or remove entropy late on, the first 12 days. And those changes themselves will affect the angular power spectrum of the CMB. So it's kind of lead into to where Gary's going to go. A wide variety of ideas have been discussed in non-standard Big Bang nuclear synthesis, such as inhomogeneity on different scales, antimatter domains, various neutrino effects, decaying particles, and so on. A summary of these is that they're used to try to reconcile the data, such as the lithium. This issue here, right? How do you get the helium and the lithium to agree with the deuterium over here, right? And generally, they've not been very successful at doing that. If you get the lithium to agree, the helium, then the lithium doesn't, right? And it's just not been very satisfying, unfortunately, in those areas. So typically, what you do is you say, look, these guys agreed as systematic errors, right? They're actually the same number, right? Guess a systematic error, and then you're going to limit the physics, right? And there are lots of papers that do that. So that's a kind of summary of roughly where it is. Yeah. Now I'm going to explain to you what we're going to do next. There are several ways forward. This is a Sloan telescope surveying the sky. It'll discover approximately 1,400 quasars, fairly faint but high redshift, in which deuterium could be measured. Now, we already know about 800. The advantage of these is they're well cataloged, easy to sort through, and so on. These can be observed at considerable expense, and we could get a better deuterium measurement from that. We could get it quite a bit better, perhaps a factor of 3 or so, something like that. So we should be able to get errors comparable to those from, let's say, MAP, and perhaps a little bit better than that. But after that, this method will run out. You can see the sort of data difficulties we have. So my request to you is that if you want deuterium measured more accurately, give us compelling reasons, and we can attempt to work out how to do it. But otherwise, we're nearing the end of the road in this area. So with that, I'll stop. Thank you.
Sort of ideal measurement. There's always this question.
Oh, yeah.
Was there an interloper?
Was there,
if the number goes wrong, then you've got an excuse.
Right? Mm-hmm. I can explain that. Okay. At the beginning, so you go back 6 years, the issue was order of magnitude. Is it 10 to minus 5 or 10 to minus 4? And the plots had that range on them, right? So you don't need much data for that, dealt with, right? We're now in the 10% region, and for that we seem to need signal-to-noise of, 50, round about there, but much worse than the Lyman limit lines. The information to answer the question, what is the D to H, is usually in the spectrum. You just need good enough data. I showed you how bad the signal-to-noise sometimes is. If you have adequate signal-to-noise, you can see the distribution of a hydrogen. The deuterium must be identical if it's deuterium. Right, so, and that makes a measurement quite easy when you know exactly what you're looking, you know where you're looking, and so on, and how much. So in the quasars I was showing you, that will work. Better data will improve the value. Combined with better modeling, we don't have the luxury of doing, let's say, full-scale Monte Carlo, where you Monte Carlo everything. We just do the bits that we think are most relevant. We now know we should model more variables. In more detail. We have to make artificial spectra, and that's quite hard because we need software that can do what a human now takes months to do, as to how I'm going to analyze this. But we know the way forward on this, and we'll do better because of that.
With lithium measurements, are they in the galaxy or are they
at home? Yep, no, galaxy. The galaxy,
so
yeah.
You always try to go outside the galaxy.
That's right. So you bring up a point, right? The lithium measurements are stars in the halo of our galaxy. They're presumably made from the same gas that I'm seeing deuterium. Right? Just different galaxy, different time, but it should be the same. Right? A good guess would be that The gas that makes deuterium absorption later became halo stars in that galaxy. Right? So it should be kind of similar, but it's not the same place. And the helium is fairly nearby galaxies, sort of way of looking at that. People would like to, obviously, cross over. The crossover, I guess, comes from the deuterium in the interstellar medium, right, which it agrees, roughly speaking. So there's no real evidence that anything is in Homo.
Very old stars, or
Halo star, beginning of galaxy, first, no, right at the beginning. Yeah, 12, yeah, right, well, yeah, because the galaxy forms from bits and so on, yeah.